This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's the 19th of March, 1920. The Irish Cup semi-final is taking place between Belfast Celtic and Glentoran. With 10 minutes to go, it's 0-0. But then Glentoran's Joe Gowdy finds himself through on goal, but at the last second is hauled down by Celtic player Fred Barrett. Then, to the shock of the Belfast Celtic supporters, the referee orders Barrett off the field. Belfast Celtic supporters invade the pitch. The referee and the players are surrounded and taken to safety by the Royal Irish Constabulary. Glentoran fans respond by throwing rocks and stones. A Celtic supporter is knocked to the ground, and as he hauls himself up, he draws a gun from his coat. He fires wildly into the crowd. Now, the crowd begins to stampede towards exits not big enough to hold such a surge. Miraculously, no one is killed. Dozens are injured. The riots would go on for 6 more hours outside the ground until the IRC finally gets control. The Cliftonville riots were the beginning of the end, a catalyst that would set off a chain reaction that would bring about the split of Southern Irish football from its Belfast masters, a north-south divide. On and off the field, Ireland is in turbulence. It was a country on the edge. On the edge of rebellion, on the edge of freedom, on the edge of civil war. And in the midst of it all, football had to find its way. Hello and welcome to Green Shoots, a history of Irish football. With me, Caelan Kerwin, an Irish footballing historian and fountain of knowledge in all things Irish football, Gary Spain. It's episode 2 where we delve into probably the most tumultuous time in Irish history, 1914 to 1923. In that time, Ireland, with growing nationalism and desire for independence, would have to deal with World War I, a war of independence, the partition of the island between North and South, and civil war, and the split in the governing body of football on the island too. So lots to talk about this week. We now have our Patreon up and running as well, where you can sign up to support the podcast for just €5 a month. We'll be introducing more membership tiers as we grow, but for now, we just love your support to get us up and running, put some social advertising behind us, etc. You can find us on patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. That's patreon.com/greenshootspodcast, where you can sign up and show your support. If you like the show, please share around to your network, wherever that might be, WhatsApp, Instagram, Facebook, or whatever platform that you use. If you'd like to become a show sponsor as well, we'd love to have you on board with us as we move forward, so please get in contact on any of our social media channels. So let's get on with this week's show. So as we kind of, I suppose, alluded to in the intro there, Gary, maybe if we have a little bit of context before we start talking about the football side of things, in terms of, this is a hugely turbulent period in not just for football in Ireland, but in Irish history. There's so many things going on in this period. World War One, the Easter Rising, independence, all of these things are come in a very, very short period of time. So maybe if you just kind of expand a little bit on what's happening in Ireland as we kind of creep towards World War One.
Yeah, so we talked in the last episode about football, basically, up until World War One. Outside of that, there was a few things happening, like Irish nationalist MPs held the balance of power in Westminster, and John Redmond had agreed that there would be some amount of home rule. This was bitterly opposed by unionist opposition, mainly from Belfast and what is now Northern Ireland. So now all of that got shelved, basically, when World War One broke out in 1914, and the whole of Europe was plunged into the war from 1914 to 1918. In the middle of that, in 1916, the Easter Rising took place. And I suppose if you look back, and I mean, people have all sorts of different views of history, but it was seen, initially it was seen as a bit of disloyalty or something, certainly across the water. In England, it was very, they were fighting the war. Lots of Irish people had gone to fight in Europe, in the trenches, in France, etc. And in Dublin, this rising took place. Even in Ireland, they didn't get a huge amount of popular support. But what I think is generally accepted as being the crucial thing, or the crucial difference, is the leaders of the rising were executed. And that caused a huge groundswell of nationalism in Dublin, in throughout the country, really.
It's the British reaction, really, isn't it, to it, rather than the actual event. The event is the headline, but it's the reaction afterwards that really compels this nationalistic influence.
Yeah, exactly. Because I mean, there were reports of some of the rising participants having rotten fruit and stuff thrown at them. Again, I mean, there's so many accounts of this, and I'm by no means an expert in any of this, but certainly the reaction and the decision to execute the leaders of the rising caused a huge swell of Irish nationalism. And in actual fact, the people who had gone, a lot of the Irishmen who had gone to fight in World War One came back in 1918 and were very often seen as traitors. And a lot of them had gone to fight for Britain on the basis that they could get home rule as a promise on the basis of this.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere in the region of about 80,000 Irish men went to fight in World War One, or certainly signed up anyway. So it's not an insignificant number either.
No, and I mean, a lot of them gave their lives. A lot of them were killed in France. Yeah. So, but certainly they came home to a very, very different country. And nationalism was certainly being highly stoked at the time. It was there was strong demands, and that fed into football as well. I mean, we talked, football has always been played by everyone on this island. So it's never been the case. It's played by all religions, all colours, etc. But that leads to its own problems, because we can go on, particularly in this episode, we'll talk about a lot of fighting, a lot of issues at games. So there was a huge swell of nationalism in Dublin and in the southern areas. Up north, there was obviously the Ulster Covenant had been signed in reaction to John Redmond's Home Rules Bill. So there was, a lot of people in Belfast were much more aware and concerned that they remain British and their loyalty to the crown. So and that happened, and that played out in football terms as well. So, and another thing that had happened was there had been a feeling south of the border. Well, there wasn't a border, of course, but there had been a feeling in Dublin that they got a bit of a raw deal, that there was the association was based in Belfast. There was a bit of a bias in picking Belfast players, that maybe more of the games were played in Belfast. Now, there were actually a lot of Southerners had played, a lot of players from Dublin. There was probably a feeling maybe there should have been more. There were actually quite a few internationals played in Dublin right up to 1913, as we discussed. And international football had actually stopped. It didn't resume again till 1919. When it came back, there weren't any senior games played in Dublin by the IFA after that, any home games. They were played in Belfast. Dublin was considered unsafe. The War of Independence broke out. People were being shot. People were being killed. And so it was in that context and that environment that the Leinster FA, as it was, decided during the War of Independence to break away from the parent body, the Irish Football Association. Mm-hmm. And just to, let's say, backtrack a little bit, the Leinster FA had been founded in 1892. There were just five clubs. It was Canon Morley was the chairman, Dudley Hussey of St. Helen's School. Dudley Hussey of Bohemians was the secretary. The main two clubs were Bohemians and Shelburne, who were playing senior football at the time. There was the Leinster Cup, which was obviously a very prestigious tournament. But in the spring of 1921, the secretary of the Leinster FA, Mr. J. Ryder, wrote to the Leinster clubs. The Munster FA, which was a lot weaker at the time, kind of gave tacit backing to this. But the Leinster FA made a decision that they were going to break away from the Irish Football Association. And that was a huge decision, a huge risk, particularly for clubs like Bohemians and Shelburne, who were playing against the bigger Belfast teams on a regular basis. Shelburne had actually won the 1920 Irish Cup final by default. The intro talks about the game between Glentoran and Belfast Celtic, which, even though it was two Belfast teams, it was a microcosm of what was happening in the island at the time. Belfast Celtic had been founded back in the 1890s. 1891 is generally accepted as the date, as the year. They were a team based on the Falls Road in West Belfast. Their support, the vast majority of them would have been Catholic nationalist. They did have players from across the community, across the sectarian divide. Glentoran are still to this day a huge powerhouse in football in Northern Ireland. Mm. They're based in East Belfast. A lot of their players and their fans would have been working in the shipyards, the Harland and Wolff shipyards. Their support would be mainly Protestant. Again, though, their players would have come from across the divide. The Glentoran famously won the Vienna Cup in 1914, a European tournament, and had with a mixed team. But
they still have the trophy in the cabinet.
They still do. And the supporters would mainly be working class, East Belfast Protestants. And the whole turmoil around that Irish Cup semi-final and the revolver, as we had in the intro, being produced, resulted in Belfast Celtic being suspended from football, and Glentoran had actually played an ineligible player, so they got kicked out as well. And Shelburne, who were waiting in the final, were awarded the cup by default.
Default seems to be the word that kind of rears its head quite a lot in these times.
They were turbulent times. I mean, the IFA very rarely actually played internationals apart from the home nations. At that point, they were the very odd game, but they did play an amateur game in France. And some Irish nationalists produced what were called Sinn Féin flags at the game. And a lot of the players refused to leave the dressing room until the flags were removed. And so it was incidents like that were increasing the tension. But it really came to a height in 1921 when Shelburne drew Glenavon in the semi-finals of the Irish Cup. And the game was fixed for Belfast, and Dublin was considered quite unsafe at the time. And the IFA were probably on their knees praying it didn't end in a draw, because the convention at the time was, if the first game was in Dublin, the replay was in Belfast. If the first game was in Belfast, the replay was in Dublin. And of course, it ended in a draw. And the IFA, in their wisdom or whatever, decided Dublin was unsafe. Shelburne were up in arms over this. They felt the replay, they were the holders of the cup, the replay should have been played in Dublin. And they withdrew and they didn't play. And that is considered to be the catalyst for the Leinster Football Association to break away from the Irish Football Association in the spring of 1921. So
is this almost like a split or death by a thousand cuts? It's not just kind of this one single focal point thing that happens. It's all these little things that kind of line up to a point where it becomes a situation where the Leinster FA just become exasperated by this constant having to push back on things that are coming down from Belfast.
Yeah, I think that it was a build-up of things, without doubt. But this Shelburne-Glenavon decision was considered the straw that broke the camel's back. Now, we can go on and talk about it because it was by no means a final. It certainly wasn't considered final at the time. But ultimately, it has proved to be to be final.
Yeah, and when it happens, there seems to be a feeling in the IFA headquartered in Belfast that this is a temporary thing. It's kind of like, you know, the Leinster FA maybe throwing their toys out of the pram a little bit, and so they kind of feel like it's a short term thing, and sometime in the near future they'll be back again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you go back, we talked the last time about how powerful the IFA were. I mean, the four home associations, they played in the home championship every year. It was a huge deal. And the Leinster FA were being totally isolated by making this decision. And I mean, they met in March 1921 in Molesworth Hall in Molesworth Street. I think it's actually the headquarters of the Freemasons now in Dublin. But they met there, and a decision was taken to break away. And it was, I think the IFA saw it as being quite temporary. So there was a meeting held between the what became the Football Association, the Irish Free State, and the IFA. So it was Sir Henry McLaughlin representing the FAI, who became the association's first president, and Captain James Wilton representing the IFA, who was later knighted himself. And they met to try and heal the breach, to come together and to try and get the Leinster FA back into the fold. And the demands of the Leinster FA were considered to be totally unreasonable. I mean, there was an agreement actually to have one national team, but there were strong demands to have equal representation, equal games in Dublin and Belfast. It would have been a huge transfer of power from Belfast to Dublin, which the IFA were certainly not willing to contemplate at the time. And they would have seen themselves as being in a much stronger position because they would have had the backing of the FA, the SFA, and, well, to less extent, the FAW Wales.
So is Leinster proposing essentially moving the HQ to Dublin, or is it, as we use a phrase that will come up, you know, in the future of Northern Ireland as well, power sharing, in terms of you split the decisions, you split the cup finals, all of these kind of things go to between Dublin and Belfast? Or is Dublin basically saying, right, we've had enough of this, it's time to start moving down here?
Well, it was more of a split. So it was going to hold alternate meetings in Belfast and Dublin. I think it was alternating home games between Belfast and Dublin. Now, Dublin at that point used to get, the home championship, Ireland had either one home game or two home games, depending on how it fell. And on the years there was one home game, it was played in Belfast, and typically from 1900, when there were two home games, one of them was played in Dublin. So Dublin effectively got, I don't know what that works out, maybe a third of the games. You can do the maths on that. So it was more of a agreement to have to make it much more equitable between Dublin and Belfast. And there was certainly a feeling in Dublin, probably correctly so, that a lot of the power resided in Belfast. And basically those in the IFA were not willing to agree to that compromise. And there was also, the national team was picked by selectors, so I think it was going to be, the selectors had to be equally drawn from Dublin and Belfast. So, I mean, the Leinster FA at this stage, by those in Belfast, were considered upstarts. I think would be a fair comment. So the proposals weren't agreed. So in June 1921, they agreed to form the Football Association of the Irish Free State.
Just on that, is there, when it comes to the Leinster FA, and I'm not quite sure how much knowledge you would have of this, but is there any dissenting voices in the Leinster FA? Is there one or two people kind of saying, look, guys, if we do this, it might not be so good for us? Or is this like a unanimous kind of decision from the Leinster FA to say, yeah, we're doing this, we're out?
Well, it certainly wasn't. It wasn't a decision taken lightly. So I think Mr. Ryder did outline very clearly the huge risk and what was being taken. So the likes of Shelburne and Bohemians were giving up their participation in the Irish Cup, in the Irish League. The St. James's Gate, as I said, were a coming team at the time. They would have been unable to join the Irish League. It was a huge risk, a huge leap into the dark. I don't know how much dissension is actually recorded. It certainly was a decision that wasn't taken lightly. I would imagine it had a lot of discussion, but it was taken. It was felt there was no option. The players were considered, although it didn't happen, that they were being effectively excluded from the Ireland national team at the time. Now, that actually didn't happen. The players continued. That's another podcast all in itself. The players, the IFA national team was an all-Ireland team up until 1950. But it was a huge risk. It was considered to be a big deal. And I mean, Shelburne and Bohemians, they really had to go along with that. They could have rebelled. They would have been very welcome to stay within the IFA and to play in the Irish League. But that would have, I imagine, killed the breakaway at the start if Shelburne and Bohemians in particular didn't go along.
Oh, yeah. Because they're two powerhouse clubs in Dublin as well. And do we know what the reaction is from other parts of the country? You mentioned Munster FA and other clubs that might have been in other parts of the country. Was there support for it? Were they tentative about it? Do we know if there's any kind of feedback from them on it?
So there was a team called Cork Celtic, which was no relation to the Cork Celtic that existed in the 1960s and 70s. But there was a team from Cork Celtic did play in the Irish Cup on some occasions. But all that I've seen that's been recorded is the Munster FA gave kind of their tacit approval to the Leinster FA to. The Munster FA was certainly considered a lot weaker. The Connacht FA hadn't been formed at this stage, didn't exist until the 1920s. Now, remember, the War of Independence was still going on at this stage. There was no treaty signed. There was no independence. There was no partition. So it was effectively the Leinster FA breaking away from the Irish FA and very much being isolated. I mean, there was no international recognition at this stage, but they took the decision and they formed the Football Association of the Irish Free State in June 1921, and then set up a league and cup. So the FAI Cup was set up for the 21-22 season. There was a league. So instead of Shelburne and Bohemians playing in the Irish League, Shelburne, Bohemians, and it was all Dublin clubs, St. James's Gate, who I mentioned, who were becoming a coming team, the Guinness Brewery side. And then some smaller clubs that had been playing in the Leinster League and the Leinster Cup. So the likes of Frankfurt, Olympia, Jacobs. So there was an eight-team league set up from 1921-22. And St. James's Gate were actually the first champions. So they surprisingly beat Shelburne and Bohemians into second and third place. So the Guinness Brewery side were the first champions, and they completed a double by winning the FAI Cup in a hugely significant game, because a non-league club, a small club by the name of Shamrock Rovers, who you might have heard of, so they'd been founded in 1899 in Ringsend, but they'd gone out of existence a couple of times and had been very much a junior club, a smaller club. They were they weren't even, wouldn't even have been considered rivals to Shelburne in those days, even though they were near neighbours. But they reached the Irish Cup final, sorry, the FAI Cup final of 1922, and lost to St James's Gate after a replay. Now, that was a hugely, hugely contentious final. There was riots on the pitch. The crowd invaded the pitch. There was contentious decisions. Shamrock Rovers, having lost the replay 1-0, invaded the St James's Gate dressing room. James Dowdle, a brother of Charlie Dowdle of St James's Gate, took exception to this and produced a revolver out of his coat pocket. And
there's a lot of revolvers at these football matches back then. Taking your life in your own hands to go to these games.
Absolutely. I mean, Bob Fulham, he was on the Rovers side, a legendary Rovers player. He ended up getting a ban over this. He was banned for quite some time. And
I suppose as well, just on that, with the backdrop of war going on within the country, I would imagine that there were guns more readily available to people. They could get their hands on them, depending on who you were, of course, much more readily than perhaps before. So guns were more freely available.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, let's go back to the general history. So at that stage in 1921, in 1919, the War of Independence had started. In 1921, in December 1921, I think it was, Michael Collins went to London and signed the treaty, which resulted in, for want of a better word, partition or independence for what is now the Republic of Ireland, for the 26 counties. So, and that, of course, led to another bitter dispute, because Eamon de Valera, as Michael Collins, it's Lloyd George, who signed the treaty, famously said, "I think I'm signing my political death warrant." And Michael Collins said, "I think I'm signing my actual death warrant," which proved to be prophetic. Mm. And so Michael Collins came back with the treaty. Dev, of course, famously refused to accept it. Feeling is he had set Collins up by sending him there. So the civil war had broken out. So in the backdrop of that, St James's Gate, Shamrock Rovers Cup final, the civil war was starting. So 1922 into 1923 was a hugely, hugely turbulent time. As you said, there were so many guns around. I mean, but there were also people playing football, playing with each other and against each other on opposite sides. I mean, the country was split with pro and anti-treaty.
So with that backdrop, we have people were trying to fight the British establishment on one hand, and the things that come with that, and then we start, obviously, with the Civil War, we fight amongst ourselves as well. So there's almost like this circle that just keeps going around, where we're in the height of an extremely turbulent time, and this trickles down then obviously into football matches, into sports matches, and has its influence and makes these disruptions and happens all of these times as well. And of course, obviously in our own history as well, the what happened at Croke Park as well, the massacre at Croke Park as well. So all of these things kind of become the front line, I suppose, of what's happening within the country too.
Yeah, they all tie into each other. It's actually remarkable that football continued. I mean, we had a league and a cup in 1921-22. We had a league again in 22-23. Another important thing happened. So the Leinster FA had become the Football Association of the Irish Free State. And so that incorporated Munster, etc. Now, another important thing happened is the Falls Road League in Belfast affiliated with the FAI. So at this stage now, you had two competing football associations on this island, both claiming to represent the island as a whole. So Belfast Celtic had been out of football because they'd been suspended over the 1920 incident. So in some ways, it was starting to split possibly around sectarian lines, although the IFA would have been a lot more powerful at that stage. So the 1922-23 season, it was still a Southern League, but Alton United from Belfast competed in the FAI Cup, and they actually won the FAI Cup. So a team from the Falls Road in West Belfast, Alton United, containing many former Belfast Celtic players, surprisingly defeated Shelburne in the final of the FAI Cup. They never got to defend their cup, actually. That's another story. And those upstarts, Shamrock Rovers, went on to win the league. They had joined the league from 22-23. And, of course, they've gone on to be the most successful club in the country with more leagues, more FAI Cups than anybody else. And that was only the start of their, I suppose you have to say, dominance going on from there. And in 1923, we were starting to become, so the Civil War had ended, there was a truce, there was peace. And it's remarkable, actually, how the country recovered from this and people that had been sworn enemies, and there was brother set against brother in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. The people came together, formed the new state.
With the advent of the GAA as well, the GAA continues to grow and expand, etc. Football becomes the push on football is that it's a foreign game. It's the representation of the British establishment, etc. And then, you know, there are people who are playing football just because they love to play football, etc., who are being told, look, you know, you'd want to stop that now because that's not the right thing to do. You know, and it's very much kind of, there's a lot of quotes from kind of players and fans at the time being told essentially, look, this, if you want to kind of stay living here, if you want to be around here, you need to stop supporting that game because that's not the game you should be supporting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I suppose I had said football was the game played by everyone. The GAA had been founded in 1884 in Thurles. In the early 1900s, the GAA introduced Rule 27, which explicitly, it was known as the ban, and it explicitly called out, it actually named football, it actually called football, football as well. They didn't try and take that name for many years after that.
They knew.
They knew. So they explicitly banned football and other foreign games. So if you played GAA, you couldn't play foreign games. Now, of course, that's another podcast all in itself. And I mean, that caused a lot of division in the GAA as well. But the GAA was very much Catholic, nationalist. And in many ways, it stayed that way. It's certainly still very nationalist to this day. There was a great quote, actually, I know from the Dublin County Board by Mr. Drumgool, who had actually been interned in Frognock during the War of Independence in the famous camp in Wales. And he was replying to somebody at the Dublin County Board about all the ban on football. And he said when he was in Frognock, he said all the people interned with him, they were all playing football, not GAA.
It's a game that, so I suppose the question then is, through all of this, how does football survive? Because it seems like it's getting surrounded by everything that's happening outside of it. It's that are beginning to influence it. How does it survive? How does it keep going?
Well, I suppose it's fair to say one of the other, I mean, jibes at football was it was the garrison game. So it was the game by the army. So it was tended to be played in garrison towns. So I suppose it's important to say it did survive in Dublin in particular. So it survived in cities. It was strong in Cork. It took a while to actually thrive in Limerick. There was some junior football, but rugby had very much taken hold in Limerick. And I suppose rugby was the working man's game in Limerick. Football had become the working man's game in Cork and Dublin. And GAA had been hugely strong in rural areas. So it was the farmer's game is too simplistic, but it was hugely strong in rural areas, in the small towns and villages. And that's really where it took hold. Rugby was still very much the game outside of Limerick, the game of the elites, the game of the middle class, the upper classes. So that's how it survived and it thrived, really. But it was a very turbulent time in the early 1920s. And it's remarkable that it did survive and it did. And then the new fledgling association actually survived these years. Now, while this was happening, there were still talks of reconciliation and talks of going back. I mean, rugby never split. So there was still just one Ireland rugby team. There was still the feeling that there would be one association, that there could be a coming together. There were talks, a number of talks held over the years, even right through the Civil War, of some kind of reconciliations of one football association for the island. And remember, at that stage, the 26 counties, as it was, still only had Dominion status, equivalent to Canada or Australia. So it was still under, well,
the umbrella of the British Empire.
The umbrella of the Empire of the Crown, etc. So we didn't become a republic until 1949. At this stage in 1923, so as we said, Alton United had won the FAI Cup. Shamrock Rovers had again beaten Shelburne and Bohemians in the second and third place in the league, as St. James's Gate had done the year before. But there was no international recognition. The FAI, the Football Association of the Irish Free State, was very much isolated. It was on its own. The French Federation did help in that a French club, Gallia, did come to Dublin and played a couple of friendlies against Bohemians and Pioneers. We were very much isolated. There was certainly no way into the home championship. The only way there would have been to rejoin the IFA. But there was another option, in that FIFA had been formed about 20 years previously, but the home associations had a bit of an on-off relationship with FIFA. They were in and they were out at various times, and we can go on and talk about stuff later on. But in 1923, the FAI then applied at the FIFA Congress in May 1923 to join FIFA. And Switzerland, actually, we should be forever grateful, proposed that we be automatically accepted. Now, that wasn't agreed, but what was agreed was there would be a working group set up to look at admitting the FAI over a couple of months. That group met over the summer of 1923, and the newspapers here all recorded in August 1923 that we were accepted and members of FIFA as of September 1st, 1923. Now, technically, that doesn't appear to be correct. And we weren't actually formally admitted to FIFA until May of 1924 and the following year's FIFA Congress. But I think that is seen as being a rubber stamp. Interestingly, actually, the only newspaper on this island to report that we were admitted to FIFA in May 1924 is the Belfast Newsletter.
Irony.
Well, the irony being that I think we'd already been effectively considered members from August to September 1923, but de facto officially members. The story for another podcast, we'll go on and talk about the Olympic Games of 1924. But following on from the 1923 FIFA admittance, then came a very important meeting. So by joining FIFA, becoming members of FIFA, we were allowed to participate in FIFA competitions. We could play against other FIFA nations. We could play representative games.
So before that, we couldn't even have friendly with, I don't know, Italy or France or something, or whoever was members at the time. We couldn't even do that. It had to be a FIFA member, and you had to be in FIFA to play those games. Is that right?
So we couldn't play any representative games. We couldn't play a senior international. We couldn't play, I mean, the representative games in those days, they were senior or full internationals, as they're known, as they are today. Amateur internationals were a huge deal in those days as well. There was an amateur home championship, which we also excluded ourselves from. Most of those games were initially held in Dublin. As far back as 1906, the first one against England, it was held in Dalymount Park. There were also interleague games, representative games. So the League of Ireland 11 would play games. So we weren't allowed to play any of those games. So the Football Association of the Irish Free State, having been formed in the spring of 1921, had not played a representative game right through 1923. So the FIFA recognition happened in August, September 1923, if only formally confirmed in May 24. In October 1923, the International Football Association Board, IFAB, which I talked about in the previous podcast, a hugely important, hugely influential organization that still exists to this day. So their meeting in Liverpool in October 1923, of the four home associations agreed that they could play against the FAI in representative games. Before that, there was no possibility that the FAI could field a representative side against any of these nations. Now, in practical terms, this only meant, so the reality was there were no international matches for almost a quarter of a century by FAI sides. We didn't play England until 1946. We didn't play Wales until 1960. We didn't play Scotland until we were drawn against them in a World Cup qualifier in 1961. So they had no choice but to play us. They didn't play us in a friendly till later. And we didn't play Northern Ireland until we were drawn against them in a competitive game in 1978. But in practical terms, what it did mean...
So basically for 25, 30 years, we just did not essentially, unless we were drawn in an official match capacity, for a qualifier, we absolutely did not play Northern Ireland, Wales, Scotland, or England.
Yeah, so well, England was a friendly. Wow. So we find England agreed to come to, and it's another story. But basically, England were playing Northern Ireland on the Saturday, the 28th of September, in Belfast in the Home Championship, and they agreed to come to Dublin the following Monday and play the FAI 11 in Dublin. So that was the first time England played against the FAI or whatever. Well, we played as Ireland in those days as well. But that IFAB meeting in October 1923 did allow for these representative games. And what did come out of that were interleague games. So a League of Ireland 11 was allowed to play against their Irish League counterparts. And actually, one of those games was arranged for 1925. But the first first representative game for the FAIFS, I have to get the acronym exactly right as it was at the time. So on the 9th of February 1924, the Welsh League or a Welsh 11 came to Dalymount Park and played a League of Ireland 11. And we played out a 3-3 draw. So it was our Welsh friends that became the first to accept an invite to play against us. The Irish League, we then played them on a regular basis in the 20s in Dublin and Belfast. So that certainly did quite a bit to heal the breach. We didn't actually get to play the Scottish League until 1939. And we didn't play the English League until 1947. But those games, based on the 1923 IFAB meeting, they were allowed. And certainly that was the start of good relations or better relations between us and the home nations. Now, I should also point out that at that stage, the IFA or Ireland, so they typically, right up until 1951 when they played France, they played very, very, very few internationals against anyone other than the home nations. I mean, they went on a trip to Norway in 1922. They played South Africa in 1924, which is actually flip-flop between a senior and an amateur international, but it's considered senior at the moment. And if you're looking at the record books, all their other internationals from 1880 right up to 1951 have been against England, Scotland and Wales. But they continue to pick players from the whole island as the Ireland team. And that continued right up to 1950 until basically the FAI went to FIFA and said, we're not having this and this has got to stop.
How does that work? Because that must be a weird kind of awkward thing, because you have the IFA saying to somebody down south, hey, come play in our in our matches, etc. When clearly there's a representative body, association body for Southern Ireland, does it put those people personally in awkward positions within their communities? Because now they've got to make a decision themselves about who they're going to play for, where their allegiance lies.
Well, a lot of them actually played for both. Now, there are this is a whole podcast all in itself as well, because although some of them were playing
I'm noticing a pattern forming. The more we delve in, the more we're like, right, that's a brand new podcast coming.
Well, it is. But I mean, so a lot of players, I mean, if you're taking players like Jimmy Dunn, who was a legendary, played for Shamrock Rovers, played for Bohemians, died as a young man, legendary striker for the FAI and for the IFA. Incredible goal scorer in the 1930s. So he played for both. The likes of Con Martin, Tommy Eglinton, Peter Farrell. And so they played for both associations right up to 1950. And the last, as such, All-Ireland team or All-Ireland team is the one that played Wales in the home championship at Wrexham in 1950. And really, what actually brought it to a final head was, so the FAI were very unhappy with this. Now, the FAI were not innocent in this either, because there was a time when the FAI decided, well, if the IFA are picking players from south of the border, hey, we're going to pick some guys from north of the border. And they actually played. So for the tour in 1946 to Spain and Portugal, the FAI actually went and picked some northern-born players, but that didn't last very long, and they really wanted their own independence. They wanted the 26 counties. In some ways, you can say it's very partitionist, and it's one of the big GAA jibes at football is that it's a partitionist sport. And the irony being, the IFA were the ones being, we're a 32-county association, we're picking players from everyone, and the FAI were the ones that picking, hey, no way, the 26 counties are ours. And it actually came to head with FIFA because for the 1950 World Cup, the FIFA decreed the home championship would be the qualifying criteria, and the top two in the home championship would qualify for the World Cup, whereas the FAI were drawn in a group. Well, they had to play Finland and Sweden. And you actually had the crazy situation in that players from south of the border had two chances to qualify for the World Cup. So the likes of Con Martin and Peter Farrell, Tommy Eglinton, etc., the great stars of the 1940s, had two shots at it. They were playing for Ireland in the home championship.
I mean, the opportunity is there to play in a World Cup. You can't really blame them. They're like, yeah, I'll take those double chances. Why not?
The players, they just wanted to play football. And I mean, it was
100%,
huge,
yeah.
It was hugely prestigious also in those days to play against the likes of England. These were huge games. The home championship was a massive competition. Ironically, another story from that World Cup that doesn't involve us, the top two qualified for the World Cup. England actually won the home championship and gladly took their place in for the first time ever in the World Cup. They actually played in it. But Scotland decided, well, we're even though second place qualifies, we're not going unless we're winners. So we're only going to go to Brazil for the World Cup if we win the home championship. They didn't win the home championship, so they turned their nose up at it and said, we're not going to the World Cup. We can play ahead without us. I don't think that
looks like madness
today.
Now. No, it wouldn't. They'd bite your hand off for that. Those intervening years just after the split, we talked very briefly in the last podcast about players, Irish players, were going over to England to play for English teams, and so on. You mentioned a couple of names as well. Does that stop after the split? They're no longer allowed to go play in those teams in Scotland or England, etc. And they're afraid, essentially frozen out?
No, I mean, there were actually a number of players. I'm not 100% sure, I'll be honest, but I don't think there was ever a block on the players going across. So certainly players like Bob Fulham that I mentioned, he went and played for Leeds. He left Rovers in the early 1920s and played at least a season with Leeds and came back to Rovers. There were a number of players playing cross-channel in those days. What it did do was it actually excluded them. But I think this was an FAI or an FAI Free State decision that we only picked home-based players. So it did exclude them from the national team. But a lot of big names at the time, Patrick O'Connell, who became a legendary man in Spain and on this island, he had been playing with Manchester United with Hull City at the time. He had won the home championship in 1914 as well. So the likes, there were certainly plenty of players from south of the border plying their trade across the water in England and Scotland. I think that was always the case, that the better players would always go to the clubs in England and Scotland. That there was better terms and conditions, better money, I mean, a better lifestyle then. Mm-hmm. So I'm not aware of any time where they were stopped from doing so or certainly prevented. And a lot of the players were already living and playing in England as well at that time.
If we were to, I suppose, wrap it up and sum up this podcast, 1914 to, I suppose, the mid to late 20s or so, what is that kind of turbulent period look like? It's, everything seems to be up in the air, the political situation in Ireland, the football situation in Ireland. So how do we kind of review it and say what happened and kind of what came from that period as well?
Well, I suppose we've talked about the period from 1914 to 1923. I mean, it's only 9 years, but in some ways, decades or centuries happened in the political environment, in the football environment. So much happened in that. I mean, Ireland was, I suppose, in 1914, quite happily part of the UK. The Act of Union had happened over 100 years earlier. We had one football team on this island. We had a very successful Irish League, Irish Cup. The Leinster FA and what became the Football Association of the Irish Free State took a very brave and very risky decision to break away and ultimately form what is now the FAI, what is now the governing body for football in the Republic of Ireland. And they went on in that very short period to get international recognition. Meanwhile, the island was in total turmoil with so many guns, as we talked about, the War of Independence, the Civil War, brother was set against brother. I mean, it was hugely turbulent times. And it's remarkable that it switched from 1923 from incredible violence and turbulence to a largely peaceful, well, I suppose effectively the last 100 years, certainly south of the border, has been a peaceful democratic state.
And I suppose in that time, just from the story, even from the story from the start of the podcast, we see those sectarian lines begin to be drawn as well in that period too. It's a tumultuous time indeed. If we look forward, maybe then to what are we going to talk about in our next podcast? Maybe there is so much in that, including maybe even some players even that might have had a podcast on their own too. But what can we expect as we kind of move into the mid-20s?
Well, I suppose we touched on the early part of 1924 and that first representative game against the Welsh League. But 1924 turned out to be hugely significant because the first national team games were played and we entered a team in the 1924 Olympics, which was a hugely significant competition from a football point of view. It was organised by Jules Rimet, who, of course, the first World Cup trophy was named after. He also organised the first World Cup in 1930. So for the Paris Olympics in 1924, the football competition, there were 22 nations organised by Jules Rimet and Henri Delaunay, who ultimately the Nations Cup or the European Championship was called after. He was heavily influential in organising this as well. We played in that. That's a huge part of the next podcast. And on to the early days of the fledgling national team games for the Irish Free State.
Thank you very much, Gary. As ever, fascinating insights into probably the most turbulent time in football and Irish history as well. A fascinating insight too. And we'll talk next time.
Great. Thanks, Kim.
Well, that's it for this week's show. A reminder that we now have our Patreon up and running as well, where you can sign up to support the podcast for just €5 a month. We will be introducing more membership tiers as we grow, but for now, we just love your support to get us up and running, put some social advertising behind the podcast. And you can do that at patreon.com/greensuitspodcast. That's patreon.com/greensuitspodcast is where you can sign up and show your support. Remember to support your local League of Ireland team as well. It's our heritage. It's our game. Thanks for listening.